¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Yeah. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. Yeah. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
It's pretty clear by now that there are several different types of angels with distinct appearances, and people have been talking about this for a long time. We don't know exactly what types descended on Mount Hermon to interfere and interbreed with the human race, as mentioned in the first book of Enoch, but if the Anunnaki or any of the ancient Sumerian depictions of gods are to be trusted, and considering the wide range of cryptid sightings from those days up until now, it's pretty safe to say that there were a few different types of angels interfering with man and subsequently creating a wide range of hybrid Nephilim giants, okay, and various other types of monsters. Today, we're going to talk about the concept that some of these giants may not have simply looked like massive humans, and that there's actually an unignorable possibility they only looked like men in the way that they were humanoid. Two arms, two legs, and whatnot. Otherwise, they might have looked more like half animal, half man. Kind of hybrids with magical and angelic attributes. And that potentially the most powerful of these giant hybrids were the ones with reptilian qualities. And this later gives rise to things like the Brotherhood of the Snake, Freemasonry, and a whole host of deviancy and the corruption of the seven sacred sciences that ultimately polluted all of mankind and skewed our vision of the entire world and what it's truly supposed to be. What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the 21CD podcast. As always, I am your ghost, John. If this is your first time here, welcome. We have a really interesting show for you today, but before we get into it, if you guys like conspiracies, cryptids, biblical analysis, philosophical hot takes, all the type of stuff that we talk about on this show, please do not hesitate to give me a follow, a like, a share, your hype points, a 5-star rating, depending on where you're hearing this broadcast. All of these things are possible ways that you can help me immediately. You don't got to give me any money, but if you're interested, there is a website, 21cdstudios.com. And if you go there, you can get yourself some merch, okay? I also have a reading list up there, and you can submit your story for a chance to be on the show yourself. All right. Without further ado, let's get into this. There's something disturbing about the serpent imagery, which is why I'm discussing specifically the serpent-style Nephilim and angels, the seraphim, in this video. I'm aware of the other types of angels and hybrids, but this video isn't focusing on them. Something scary seems to be structurally embedded in the text on the serpent itself, which has driven me to focus on them specifically for this video. What later Christianity trained people to read as a clean war between God's side and the serpent's side could actually preserve traces of a far older sacred order in which serpentine imagery was not outside of the divine court, but more near its center. And that kind of changes a few things and leads us into the mystery of what was going on in the land outside the Garden of Eden before Adam. Because it appears something may have been, something that perhaps involved a kingdom of lizard types, reptilian types, snake types, perhaps dragon types, maybe even something that we would later call dinosaurs. Were they smited because the seraphim played on earth once before? We see all their bones. The inquiry extends beyond this linguistic connection between seraphim and fiery serpents then, and it leads us further to the question of why does the throne room narrative continue to incorporate terminology that's associated with entities that are traditionally perceived as fearsome serpentine beings? We hear about these seraphim, these serpent beings, singing holy, holy, holy before God himself. Furthermore, why is purification mediated by beings whose designation may evoke notions of venom and fire and the wilderness curse? Remember when Moses put the fiery brass serpent on a stick and those that looked upon it would have the venom wounds from the serpents in the desert cured? Maybe the biblical text is preserving the memory of a suppressed history that we are just not yet really meant to understand fully. In that older layer, in those older days, the serpent was not merely the enemy below, lurking in the grass. It was a symbol of divine authority, maybe, of judgment, sacred fire. And later, readers and philosophers and writers who were horrified by the ambiguity flattened the entire symbol into Satan alone. He is this serpent, this dragon. But in my opinion, the text never really gets the full picture across. It kept leaving these clues to something older, something bigger than just something that crept up in the Garden of Eden and deceived man and woman. The Bible may not depict a universe where serpent symbolism was expelled from holiness. It may depict a universe where serpent symbolism was split, where there was a certain type of serpent order that didn't necessarily start out as evil. The Bible is for us, it's for humans. But there was something else going on in the heavenly host, perhaps, that we just don't even know about because it's not written about in the Bible. Perhaps the angelic kind have their own Bible. And in their Bible, they might also have these stories of rebellion and deceit and chaos. So I argue that maybe the serpent imagery might be sort of divided into these fractured reflections of the same ancient symbolic reality. Now, this could become a genuinely dangerous idea to many people because it means that the line between divine presence and divine terror was once much thinner than people want to admit. It means the heavenly world was not originally imagined as clean and harmless and perfect, but as something that had a certain predatory nature to it, filled with beings that did not merely comfort like your guardian angels, but also contained the possibility of overwhelming and playing upon the face of the earth outside the Garden of Eden in hazardous ways. It appears they may have even had the opinion that the earth was theirs, these seraphim and these angelic kind, for a time at least, until Adam showed up and drove them to jealousy and then lust. If later Christianity had to essentially moralize the serpent into a one-dimensional villain, Satan, then maybe it was not only trying to protect the doctrine. Maybe it was trying to hide the older architecture. Because if people realized that serpent imagery could signify not just evil, but also sacred presence, as it appears to do, a sort of purifying presence that worships the Lord, then the symbolic map of Scripture changes a little bit. Suddenly, Eden is not so simple. Isaiah is not so simple when he talks about these beings worshiping the Lord. Moses is not so simple when he raises the staff with the serpent on it. Even the language of Satan becomes more like a civil war inside something older than the Bible really tells us. It might not just be that the serpent invaded holy things, such as the Garden of Eden. It might be that holy things were never entirely free of the serpent to begin with. And that doesn't mean that God is the serpent. The biblical world may preserve a memory of divine symbolism that was later partitioned, later censored, and redistributed into acceptable and unacceptable forms. So what had once been a complex sacred image, perhaps of the seraphim, was broken apart. A civil war in the heavens over the earth, because the earth was once the domain of these beings before Adam came along and inherited it. After all, in the holy hierarchy, man was made to rule the angels. But the angels, it would appear, came first. We have multiple resets in the Bible, for instance, such as Noah and the Ark, the Tower of Babel. Just because the Bible starts with "in the beginning" and a creation story doesn't mean that we understand everything that came before day one and Adam. Adam is not where the story starts, it would appear. Perhaps outside the garden were dragons and dinosaurs and the man that was made in day six, and angels performing in ways of creation in their image. When God woke from his rest on day eight, it seems he may have created Adam. But man and woman were said to be made on day six. Genesis 1:26 details this. It says, "And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And God blessed them, and God said unto them, "Be fruitful, and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth." This is Genesis 1:26. Genesis 2:1 says, "Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them." And then he rested. This is Genesis 1:26 through 28. Then in the next chapter, Genesis 2:1 says, "Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them." Okay, so the hosts of the heaven and the earth were finished, and then God rested. So he made all the heavens and essentially everything, except it maybe, this is just conjecture, I'm just thinking out loud here, but except it would seem Adam and Eve. God took a nap. So what happened during his rest? Now up until this point, basically Genesis 2:3, everything has been in very boldly outlined chronological order. Day 1, day 2, etc. All the way up until day 7, and then God rested. And then Genesis 2:4, suddenly we start to hear of the generations of the Genesis. Now, this, I want to make it clear, this is just a theory, because we could easily say that we were told the creation story, and then we were told the generations. But what's peculiar is that Adam and the Garden of Eden aren't mentioned until sometime after day 7, after the rest. Matter of fact, the garden is specifically planted by God after creation, it seems, it sounds like. Scholars call it day 8, but we really don't know when exactly it is. We don't know what day it is. It's just, it seems that it's certainly after day 7, and it specifically says that there was no woman suitable for Adam in the garden after Adam was created. So neither Eve nor anyone like her is to be found on the earth for Adam, despite the fact that God has told man and woman to multiply on day 6. Now, perhaps this is all a side note. The Bible doesn't have contradictions. I don't really know. Perhaps it explains how Earth was populated so quickly, though. Perhaps it explains all of the people that Cain was worried about when he was given the mark, and he was afraid he was going to be hunted down by all the people on the planet. Perhaps this is where this explains how he was able to find a wife and Nod so quickly after being banished. It's not necessarily contradictory, though, to say that Adam came at the end of a reset or at the beginning of a new age, of a new time. We have the creation of the world and we have the creation of man. Then Adam, then Eve. Because these other women weren't good enough, it sounds like. And then a serpent referred to as a brute came along and basically mucked up the whole thing. And God said, you're going to writhe about on your belly now. So is this perhaps when the dinosaurs were smited? Obviously, we're just talking here. If we were sitting around a little campfire shooting the shit, this is what... These are the types of words I would be saying. Is it possible that the crafty reptilian brutes of the earth were in these days and subsequently lost because of this curse? When God cursed the serpent to crawl upon its belly, did he also kill off all the dinosaurs that perhaps the seraphim were making in these days? Maybe. And like the Nephilim, some seem to have emerged later, perhaps as the dragons of myths and fables that we read about. This is all just something to chew on. Don't take everything I'm saying too seriously unless you have, you know, reason to do so. You've done your own research, because I'm not saying this is truth. I'm pondering. But this is why we're going to follow the trail of these serpent brutes, because it does appear that these types, these seraphim, are a little bit different than the other angels. In Gary Wayne's books and his related material, he does not describe the Nephilim as merely oversized humans. He kind of frames them as something a little bit different, sometimes being giant hybrid beings with a distinctly serpentine and uncanny appearance. On his own site, he says that the Nephilim had heads like snakes, at least some of them, and rough and hairy skin and eyes of honey and gold, and that they gave off a kind of glow, which is why he links them to the label the Shining Ones. He also ties their appearance to great size and strength, presenting them as kind of physically dominant over ordinary humans. Wayne argues that their imposing form was part of how they ruled and terrified people. They were scary to behold, not just because they were giant humanoids, but because they were giant hybrids, sometimes of this serpent-like appearance. Beyond that, Gary Wayne also associates Nephilim imagery with serpentine facial features and elongated skulls, some of which have been found. And Gary also talks about other versions of Nephilim, for sure. I don't want to say that he thinks all of these Nephilim looked the same. He mentions lion men. He mentions the Tengu raven Nephilim. He mentions the dog Nephilim. But one more thing that matters in Wayne's framework is that he argues that their modern descendants may not visibly look like giants anymore. His book materials say that their bloodlines kind of extend back to the Nephilim, even if they may not look like giants today, however. And this is where my NPC theory comes in, because in my opinion, what the Nephilim were in the old days may in many situations be cryptids or even NPCs, these human-like non-humans who live among us and are easily manipulated by every push and pull of the media, the government, easily turned to violence, cannibalistic, easily manipulated by all of the influences of this world, as well as by psychopaths and sociopaths and being psychopaths themselves and serial killers and individuals with no internal monologue. It's sometimes said that the Nephilim were not smart enough, for instance, to create a religion based around them themselves, and that they had to convince humans to do that for them, because they don't necessarily possess the imagination or creativity that God gave to humans when he created them in his image. Because day six man, if they are separated from Adam, they're still made in God's image. They're just different people. But they're made in God's image. It's possible that Adam was essentially like the first priest of God's holy order, of God's great plan, and the garden could be thought of as a sort of temple. But if these NPCs, these human-like non-humans, For instance, we hear about how so many people don't have an internal dialogue or real imagination. That's a Nephilim trait, it would appear. And so that would explain why some people don't have them, have those things, because they are descendant of a Nephilim bloodline. They are descended from giants. They are descendants of this hybrid sort of race. So, boiled down, Gary Wayne's reptilian-style Nephilim are kind of described by him as giant, hybrid, serpent-like beings with rough or hairy, sometimes pale skin, golden, honey-colored eyes, a glowing or shining quality, and in some cases elongated skull or other non-human features, including a long neck. All of a sudden, you have entities with reptile heads and necks, maybe reptile fingers, claws, and teeth, maybe slit eyes, at a minimum, maybe glowing eyes, as described. And he pulls a lot of this information from ancient texts, such as like Josephus and some of these other Sumerian and ancient Babylonian and Mesopotamian writings. Frustratingly, the Bible is actually the most restrained when it comes to describing these Nephilim. It's kind of interesting, but also frustrating. In Genesis 6:4, the Nephilim are mentioned briefly, and they're associated with the sons of God and the daughters of men. But the text doesn't really give a physical description, like skin tone or eye color or any of their traits. It mainly presents them as beings that are tied to might and fame and abnormal stature or power. And then in Numbers 13:33, we see the spies that go into the promised land, and they say the Nephilim made them feel like grasshoppers in comparison, which obviously suggests the size of exceptional proportions. But again, the description is still kind of sparse and not anatomically detailed. The Book of Enoch says that the giants are described as the offspring of the Watchers and human women, and the emphasis kind of shifts from mere renown to enormous size and violence, corruption, and cannibalism and blood drinking. So again, we hear a lot about their traits, but not necessarily what they look like. But we never necessarily hear that they just look like giant men. And if you look at a lot of these ancient carvings from all of these ancient civilizations, I mean, just look at the Egyptian gods. Look at the Mesopotamian gods. Look at the ancient Sumerian gods. Look at the Anunnaki. You see hybrids. You see giant hybrids. And Gary Wayne's, not to freeload off his material, but I'm reading his book right now. And in his Genesis 6 conspiracy, he outlines multiple tribes of Nephilim. You have, he says, Unger defines the Emites or Eman as giant aborigines who occupied the land east of the Jordan River and who were dispossessed by the Moabites. The name Eman was derived from the fear that they inspired because of their sinfulness and size. And then you've got the Zanzimites, who were defined as noisemakers, likely from the thunderous bellows of their voices that Atlanteans and Titans were well known for, and or those that mumbled, and or those who murmured. Then you've got the Ammonites, who destroyed them. The word Zamzamine further describes the talent that these giants had in war, for in other accounts they were considered masters of war. Avites or Avim described iniquitous giants who dwelled among the Philistines in Gaza and identified with the Hivites. The Azim dwelled in Ham and were translated as shining people. In a similar manner, Luvim, the name provided by Egyptians, described their snake-like qualities and their ability to easily judge the quality of the soil. Rephaites were additionally understood to be giant aborigines from much older races. The alternative translation to Rephaite reflects that at a glance, a person's heart would grow weak from the terribleness of the giant's appearance. That's from his book, Genesis 6 Conspiracy. I recommend it if you want to check it out. The seraphim of Isaiah 6 occupy one of the strangest corners of the biblical imagination because they seem to stand at sort of the crossroads of heaven and fire and this bizarre serpent imagery. In Isaiah's vision, they appear as six-winged beings stationed around the throne of God, crying out, "Holy, holy, holy." And they veil themselves in the divine presence and kind of act as agents of purification when one touches Isaiah's mouth with a burning coal. Yet the word used for them, seraph, comes from the same Hebrew root used elsewhere in Scripture for the fiery serpents of the wilderness. And I think that detail opens a far older and more unsettling layer beneath the text, because the same language that evokes these celestial attendants in Isaiah also evokes venom and burning and judgment and serpentine threat in books of the Bible like Numbers and Deuteronomy and later prophetic passages. So this is why many scholars and interpreters have long suspected that the seraphim were not originally imagined as these soft, abstract angels in the kind of modern sense that we view them as today. I mean, not as like us, but when people imagine angels, they're probably not imagining giant serpents with multiple sets of wings. It is, in fact, maybe not so stupid to say that these beings were looking more like what we see in Near Eastern imagery from the old times, especially the kind found in Egypt and the Levant, because in that world, the serpent wasn't viewed as merely an animal. It was a symbol of divine power and danger and kingship and sacred fire. And why would it be viewed that way in those ancient times for no reason? Maybe it's because they saw a different type of serpent than we imagine when we hear that word. Maybe they saw a serpent that behaved more like a god. Egyptian iconography, in particular, gives us the image of Uraeus, the rearing cobra associated with royal authority and divine guardianship. That's what the pharaohs modeled their crown or their headpiece off of, right? Even when we look at modern medical symbols, there's snakes involved. All of this is very interesting when you consider what the seraphim did as an angelic being, what its role was. So against that backdrop, the seraphim of Isaiah begins to look less like this soft, feathered choir of figures of later Christian art, and more like this very powerful throne guardian, sort of drawn from an older symbolic vocabulary of serpent-like holiness. When they mated with human women, and the Nephilim burst forth from these human women, because that is how the Nephilim were born. These women did not give birth in the natural way to these beings. It most likely destroyed the woman host as it was birthed, okay? So when these monsters came forth, they probably looked more serpent-like, but the seraphim, they probably looked very holy. They probably looked very holy. They still exist. These beings possess human-like features, including faces and feet and hands, but much of their form seems to be concealed beneath their six wings. They're not these crawling creatures of chaos, but attendants of the divine court. They speak, they worship, and they cleanse. They are things to that shouldn't, it doesn't appear that they should be feared in the way that you would fear something that's horrifying. But almost like if you saw them coming, you would rejoice, because God's mighty soldiers are coming. And yet some of them rebelled and became evil and put these Nephilim hybrids inside human women. So the linguistic connection is kind of impossible to ignore, because you have the fiery serpents of the wilderness that bring pain and judgment and the sting of sin. And then you have the seraphim of the throne room who are also burning, but their fire is not evil. It's no longer destructive. It purifies, as a matter of fact. The same root that once suggested venom and death becomes, in Isaiah's vision, an image of holiness so intense that it sears away defilement. So who's to say that this didn't happen before? before Adam, after the earth was made and while God was resting. But whatever their precise origin, the seraphim remain pretty unsettling, because beneath all those wings and that worship, there is the appearance of something that we have been taught is dangerous, a serpent. So let's dissect what exactly seraphim means. The word seraphim is the plural form of the Hebrew word seraph, and some of you guys mentioned this to me in the comments while I was discussing putting this episode out. And this word seraph means to burn or to destroy. We see fiery serpents causing damage, causing death and attack, but then we also see the same image healing. It's almost as if God is saying, yes, these beings, they certainly are my creation and I made them, and they have the power to heal you, but some have chosen to attack you. Or you should fear, you should perhaps think twice about these angels sometimes, because they're not all good. Even the ones that are bad have brothers who are good that look just like them. Deuteronomy 8:15 says, "He who led you through the great and terrible wilderness with its fiery serpents and scorpions and its thirsty ground where there was no water, he who brought water for you out of the rock of flint." Then there's the pronouncement concerning the animals of Negev in Isaiah 30 and chapter 30, verse 6. "Through a land of distress and anguish, from where come lioness and lion, viper and flying serpent. They carry their riches on the backs of young donkeys and their treasures on camel's humps to a people who will not benefit them." Now, it's possible there was a species of flying serpent that is being mentioned. There are historical accounts of flying serpents in Egypt, for instance, that are as bad as rats, and they will bite and sometimes kill. In some cases, the word seraph is modified by the adjective flying, meopep, which may indicate the swift movement of the snakes, or perhaps their ability to leap or glide. Again, in Isaiah 14, verse 29, you have the prophet, and he uses the image of a flying serpent as a metaphor for a new enemy that will arise from the ruins of Babylon. That's kind of interesting. The word flying could also suggest a connection with the sky or the divine realm, as we'll see later. But the origin of the concept of seraphim is not exactly clear. Maybe it's related to the Egyptian Uraeus serpent, a cobra-like figure that was worn on the forehead of Egyptian gods and kings as a symbol of protection and power. That serpent was believed to spit fire at the enemies of its wearer. That motif was also well known in Palestine from the Hyksos period, which was 1650 to 1550 BC, and then through the Iron Age, which went until 586 BC. And we see evidence of that on the jewelry and the tablets and the carvings. Another possible source of inspiration for the concept of seraphim is Mesopotamian mythology, where serpentine beings are often associated with thunder and with lightning. For example, in the Enuma Elish, the Babylonian creation epic, you've probably heard of it, the god Marduk defeats the primordial dragon Tiamat and her allies, who are described as sharp-toothed serpents and venomous dragons. Again, I'm thinking about dinosaurs. You know, they always say if you knew the truth, it would blow your mind. This would blow my mind. And I'm not saying to imagine that this is true. You will have to come to that decision on your own. But if dinosaurs are more closely related to angels than we even realize, more closely related to seraphim or Nephilim than we even realize, to the point that these dinosaur skulls actually belonged on, like, beings that had a kind of intelligence and deviancy to them, where they were actually manipulating the human race because they could communicate and they could enforce and they were on human-like bodies, that would be diabolically crazy. That's something that is just very interesting to imagine, because I never thought about that until very, very recently, like within the past couple days. I always thought that, yeah, there's the possibility that dinosaurs are dragons. Dinosaurs are Nephilim in some kind of way. Like they're sort of like Dogman or like any of these other cryptids, like, you know, like dragons, like the mythological tale of dragons. But lately I've been thinking about them more as like angelic descendants who actually had like a plan. Like they were manipulating mankind to build them buildings and build them kingdoms, and they were getting them to worship them. They weren't just brainless lizards wandering the planet that got smited by some asteroid or something. They might have actually been the Nephilim themselves, and not a creature that the Smithsonian and the museums and the history keepers of the day who want to manipulate our timeline and deceive us, they might not be the things that replaced the giants. Because when we find these giant bones, I tend to believe that they turn them into dinosaurs, or they turn them into mammoths, or things like that. That's how they explain the great size. But it's possible that the giants and the dinosaurs were one and the same, because they were hybrids. They were reptilian Nephilim. I'm just saying, it's something to think about. This episode is a little bit different than the others, because I'm not coming at you with diabolical information that you like I can prove or anything. It's more like an insane hot take than anything. But Tiamat and her allies, who are described as these sharp-toothed serpents and these venomous dragons, these dinosaurs, well, Marduk uses Tiamat's body to create the heavens and the earth, and places her eyes as sources of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. And then in another myth, Marduk slays another dragon called Mashusu, who is kind of depicted as a hybrid creature with a snake's head, a lion's body, an eagle's wings, and a scorpion's tail. And we kind of hear about this creature in Revelation. These are the monsters that are supposed to plague mankind in the end times. And so that begs the question, what are these things? Perhaps Nephilim. And then Marduk takes Mashusu as his emblem and mounts him on his chariot. When you look at 1st and 2nd Enoch, the seraphim are described as one of the highest orders of angels, which would explain how the stories have persisted so long. They, of course, stand side by side with the cherubim, which is what Satan is supposed to be, and the Ophanim. And they're said to be the sleepless ones who guard the throne of God's glory, according to 1 Enoch 71:7, the seraphim are. They're also involved in various heavenly activities, like we've already mentioned, such as singing these praises and interceding for humans, delivering messages, interestingly enough, executing judgments, and fighting against evil. You know, when we see the archangels, first of all, the archangels, they may be a separate type of angel altogether, one that is humanoid, perhaps. But the reason that humans imagine angels as humanoid, is as humans with wings, is because that's how they appear to us in the Bible a lot of the time. Oftentimes, you know, like even in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah or Jacob's ladder or any of those things, these angels appear as men, and they appear as humanoid. And so that's where we get that vision. But that could be a form that they take to talk to us so that we're not horrified at beholding them. Or there might actually be a humanoid angelic type as well. Perhaps that's what we will become when we are completed. I don't know. But in later Christian traditions, the seraphim are often regarded as the highest rank of angels, surpassing even the cherubim in glory and closeness to God, and they're usually depicted as these human-like figures with six wings and radiant faces. But they're also associated with love and wisdom and light and fire. So we have this sort of different image taken by Christianity. Taken up by Christianity, I should say, for the seraphim that isn't serpentine. So what we're kind of seeing here is that the seraphim kind of reflects different representations of an ancient concept over the course of time. And depending on the perspectives and purposes of different authors and different artists and different witnesses even, these beings have undergone various transformations. They've changed from winged serpents to heavenly singers, from adversaries to allies, and vice versa. In his book, The Unseen Realm, the late biblical scholar Dr. Michael Heiser, which a lot of you guys probably have probably heard of, he says, the pivotal character of Genesis 3 is the serpent. The Hebrew word translated serpent is nechash. The word is both plain and elastic. The most straightforward meaning is the one virtually all translators and interpreters opt for, serpent. When the Hebrew root letters N-C-H-S-H are a noun, that's the meaning. But N-C-H-S-H are also the consonants of a verb. If we changed the vowels to a verbal form, because recall that Hebrew originally had no vowels, we would have Nechesh, which means the diviner. Divination refers to communication with the supernatural world. So, in Genesis 3, Heiser says basically that the word used to describe the villain holds a triple meaning, referring to a serpent, a diviner, and a shining one. And he's kind of been called all three in the Bible, hasn't he? The qualities of diviner and shining one are also attributed to other divine beings. Revelation 12:9 says, and the great dragon was thrown down, that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, that deceiver of the whole world. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. It's interesting that Satan is sometimes called a serpent, which would indicate seraphim, and sometimes called a cherub, isn't it? Because the cherub or the cherub, they are generally considered to have like lion's heads, which is distinctly different from a serpent. So which is it? Perhaps the dragon and the serpent is just symbolic, but why? Perhaps it's because these seraphims, even if Satan is not one, they are serpent-like and deviant and clever and creative. And they are the ones that Satan has chosen to sort of deceive because of these reasons. He has chosen to take these seraphim and make them his army, if you will, his watchers, his group of angels to take over the world. I'm not going to say that Satan is a seraphim. I know in the Bible somewhere he's specifically called a cherub, but this all implies a closeness with the seraphim, or at least a recognition that these reptilian angel types are not to be trusted, and that they have done things in the past that have proven that fact. Because, I mean, think about it. A snake doesn't deceive anybody. A snake is just a snake. It's a cold-blooded reptile. You can go to PetSmart and Petco and buy one for $75. So this must be in reference to something that's more intelligent and deceptive, something of the seraphim type. It's an idea, at least. In his work Antiquities of the Jews, Flavius Josephus, who lived from 37 to 100 BC, he wrote, they removed their camp to Hebron, and when they had taken it, they slew all the inhabitants. They were till then left the race of giants, who had bodies so large and countenances so entirely different from other men that they were surprising to the sight and terrible to the hearing. The bones of these men are still shown to this very day, unlike to any credible relations of other men. So we have giants that don't look like men. That's what I'm hearing. Of course, we could interpret this as we have giants who look like giant men, but he specifically says countenances so entirely different from other men, and then sort of doubles down and says they were surprising to the sight, and then continues. Apparently, he had seen them because he said the bones of these things are still visible to this day, that they were unlike to any credible relations of other men. Very interesting. Diodorus Siculus writes somewhere around 50 BC, after the Greeks took hold of these ancient stories of gods. He says the first mortal woman with whom Zeus lay was Niobe, the daughter of Pheronius, and the last was Alcmene, who, as writers of myth state in their genealogies, was the 16th lineal descendant from Niobe. It appears then that Zeus began to beget human beings with the ancestors of this Alcmene and ceased with her. That is, he stopped with her his intercourse with mortal women, since he had no hope that he would beget in after times one who would be worthy of his former children and was unwilling to have the better followed by the worse. I'm bringing this up because it appears that these beings stopped, they began to degrade. Their appearance and powers began to degrade over time. And by the time we get to the Greek stories, it appears that these things are not able to continue with the same sort of legitimacy as they once had in the old days, say around the Garden of Eden days, the Sumerian or Mesopotamian days. And after this, when the giants about Pelene chose to begin the war against the immortals, Heracles fought on the side of the gods and slayed many of the sons of Earth, and received the highest approbation. And this seems to imply that there was a time that the gods stopped their strangeness with human women. Perhaps this is when the cloning seasons began, and we began to get into a different era of Nephilim interference, when they were more spiritual, and they began to tamper with humans scientifically instead of sexually. This is just an idea, but it is one that I like to believe, and this might be the reason that we don't see these monsters on the face of the planet anymore. They had to evolve their strategy. It wasn't working. The humans wanted to kill them. And eventually, they had these civil wars where they were killing each other as well. And so, because you got to remember, these demons and these fallen ones, they're not all on the same team all the time. They fight with each other, too. They don't just fight with us. So, they developed their strategy, they became more invisible, they became more palatable to the human eye, and more easy to hide amongst us, you could say. Backing this up, in the year 8 AD, Ovid wrote, "And when this god, which one is yet unknown, had carved asunder that discordant mass, had thus reduced it to its elements, that every part should equally combine, when time began, he rounded out the earth and molded it to form a mighty globe. On earth, the brute creation bends its gaze, but man was given a lofty countenance and was commanded to behold the skies, and with an upright face may view the stars. And so it was that shapeless clay put on the form of man, till then unknown to earth. Piety was slain, and the last of all the virgin deity, Astraea, vanished from the blood-stained earth. And lest ethereal heights should long remain less troubled than the earth, the throne of heaven was threatened by the giants, and they piled mountain on mountain to the lofty stars. But Jove, omnipotent, shot thunderbolts through Mount Olympus, and he overturned from Ossa huge, enormous Pelion. And when these dreadful bodies lay overwhelmed in their tremendous bulk, so the fame reports, the earth was reeking with the copious blood of her gigantic sons, and thus replete with moisture, she infused the steaming gore with life renewed, so that a monument of such ferocious stock should be retained. She made that offspring in the shape of man, but this new race alike despised the gods, and by the greed of savage slaughter proved a sanguinary birth. The time when serpent-footed giants strove to fix their 100 arms on captive heaven, not more than this event could cause alarm for my dominion of the universe. Although it was a savage enemy, yet warred we with a single source derived of one. Now must I utterly destroy this mortal race." Wow. So this was written while Jesus was alive. In modern times, we have something that sounds more familiar, and you're probably already thinking about it. We have the reptilians, often called archons, or reptoids or reptiloids or saurians or draconians or simply lizard people. They are supposedly these reptilian humanoids. And this kind of continues in the same vein, don't you think? You could, after listening to this podcast episode, potentially link these reptilians all the way back to the dinosaurs and say that they share the same blood. And these beings, they have sort of infiltrated our entertainment. They play a prominent role in fantasy and science and fiction and science fiction and ufology and conspiracy theories. And the idea of reptilians was really popularized kind of recently by David Icke, who's a conspiracy theorist who claims that shape-shifting reptilian aliens essentially control Earth by taking on human form and gaining political power to manipulate human societies. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Sounds a lot like Nephilim to me. Sounds like the Nephilim that we have been talking about since ancient times. Icke stated on multiple occasions that many world leaders were or are at least possessed by so-called reptilians. But what if they're not possessed? What if they are controlled? Or what if they are clones? Perhaps they are these psychopaths from Nephilim bloodlines. Perhaps they are not entirely humans. They are NPCs as well, but they are powerful ones. Some conspiracy theorists say that the extraterrestrial hypothesis can be linked to these reptilian entities, that they come from the Draco constellation, allies with nefarious extraterrestrials from the Orion constellation. So they're coming from the stars. That would make sense, since that's where the firmament is. That's where the seraphim would come from. Others say, of course, that they're interdimensional, coming from another universe or dimension. That's kind of the way I lean. They don't sound so new of concepts when you back them up against the Nephilim story. This is why I said in the when you stack them up against the Nephilim story, I should say. This is why in my last episode I said that it's very important that people believe in giants. Literally, it's very important that they believe in actual gigantic humanoid entities that existed as a result of angels mating with human women. Because everything can be explained through the Nephilim. They are the tangible evil that man needs to fear going against God. Humans need to see it to believe it, right? This is why. This is the vision. And we are in a particularly dark period right now because we can't see the evil anymore. We can't see the Nephilim. We can't see the giants on the horizon. But we can see them in entertainment. The stories have persisted. If you don't want to look at the ancient ones, look at stories like Conan the Barbarian. Okay? Look at the Shadow Kingdom. Look at Atlantis, Lemuria. Look at Helen Blavatsky's The Secret Doctrine. She refers to dragon men who once had a mighty civilization on a Lemurian continent. We have Robert E. Howard, who refers to these serpent men that were described as humanoids with human bodies and snake heads who were able to imitate humans at will and who lived in underground passages and used their shape-shifting and mind-control abilities to infiltrate humanity. You have Clark Ashton Smith, who used Howard's serpent men in his stories, as well as themes from H.P. Lovecraft. And he, Howard, and Lovecraft all together laid the basis for the Cthulhu mythos, which sounds a lot like what we've got going on in these biblical stories as well. In the 1940s, American occultist Maurice Doreal, also known as Claude Doggins, wrote a pamphlet entitled Mysteries of the Gobi, that describe a serpent race with bodies like man, but heads like a great snake. And they also had the ability to take human form. And these creatures also appeared in the poem, The Emerald Tablets, in which he referred to emerald tablets written by Thoth, an Atlantean priest king. These entities later formed the basis for David Icke's book, The Children of the Matrix. Then you have historian Edward Guimont, who has argued that the reptilian conspiracy theory, particularly as expanded upon by Icke, drew from early pseudo-historical legends that were developed by the colonization of Africa. Regardless of what we think happened, what we know happened, because we see this today, it's the only reason we're talking about it, is that ancient cultures preserved memories of divine, or at least semi-divine, rulers. They preserved this serpent symbolism. It was deeply tied to power and sacred knowledge. It was deeply connected with these priestly elites who acted as gatekeepers of civilization. And it was also deeply connected to hidden knowledge that somehow persisted and persists to this day. These Brotherhoods of the Snake are responsible for the way that we view the world today, through these corrupted sciences. And we haven't even begun to talk about how they've muddied the bloodlines, potentially giving rise to millions, if not billions, of NPCs on this planet. Whether it is what we say it is, or whether it's something like we think it is, by understanding where concepts like Freemasonry and the Brotherhood of the Snake and all that kind of stuff came from, and connecting it to the modern alien story of reptilians and all that kind of stuff, and tracing it back through all of this and connecting it once again to the giants, the Nephilim, that we should believe in, and recognizing that they too probably looked like serpents to a certain degree, had serpent-like figures at a minimum. Because why? Because their fathers had serpent-like tendency, the seraphim, in some situations. We are able to pull the disguise off of the enemy in our midst, and we are once again able to imagine those beings. It allows us to see them in our imagination. If we can't see them physically, we can at least trace back, like we can trace our lineage back to Adam, and we can see the source of the evil that has destroyed humanity and ultimately has steered us away from God, has distorted the way that life should be. We are able to display the villain for all to see. Anyway, thanks for watching, everybody. This one was a bit of a ramble, but kind of fun. And see you next time. The life is in the blood.